Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Chance, and welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars. That, by the way, is Australian slang for no chance. For instance, to the question, is anyone besides Max Verstappen going to win this weekend? One might respond, Buckley's chance. I'm Drew Scanlon. Joining me, Rob Zagney. How are you, Rob?
Not bad. Do we have etymology for that saying?
Yes.
When you came across it?
Yes. Buckley was an escaped white convict who went and lived with the Aboriginal people in the 1800s. And it was deemed that he would have no chance after escaping prison living with them out in the bush.
But it sounds like that worked out okay.
It did. He lived there for 30 years.
Okay. So in some ways, we could say that that saying actually sort of reflects, like, sometimes your racist assumptions about who people are and how they will react to strangers are, like, completely wrong. And it turns out, like, things can work out. So I think it seems like Buckley's chance, sort of the true story, is, like, maybe people not recognizing our common humanity sufficiently. And honestly, if I'm talking using a casual context, you're telling me you got Buckley's chance? I'm saying you're saying there is a chance.
Well, that's what we like to do here, everyone, at Shift F1, is tell you there is a chance. If you're new to this podcast, for everyone, well, I should mention Danny O'Dwyer on assignment this week. He is missed. He'll be back soon. If you're new to this podcast, a very warm welcome to you. And if you are new to Formula One itself, we recommend listening to our preseason primer episode, which assumes no prior F1 knowledge and explains how the sport works and who everybody is. So if you'd like to go back and listen to that, it's episode 257. Also, this show would not be possible without our audience over at patreon.com/shiftf1, where every week we release an ad-free version of the podcast, along with bonus podcasts and videos monthly that are exclusive to our patrons that cover racing documentaries and films, F1 video games, experiments with other racing series, and a lot of weird things. So if you would like to support the show and get access to all that fun stuff, head over to patreon.com/shiftf1 or click the link in the show notes. This month, we have been diving deep into Drive to Survive Season 6. We've posted our reviews, I suppose, our chats about episodes 1 through 5 already this month. And then as soon as April rolls around, we'll post our thoughts on 6 through 10. I've had a good time talking about this season. And of course we could not do it without our title sponsors over at patreon.com/shiftf1, including, Get Rich or Die Ryan, Agave ATX, Cyphus Training -Surf, Turf SCS, at Team Blackjack, Michael Maves, Gordy's Army, at Talking Autos, Olivia Evans, TelemetryDeck.com, FTC, Drew Stewart, Bailey Foot, Abdullah Althani, MasterCard, Venmo, JC Racing, F1 Team, Abraham Getchell, The Space Above Us Podcast, Bunny Crimes Appreciates the 14 Hours of Sleep, period. Sniggs, Alice Goucher, Max Voltar, Circuit Demon, Troy Stammer, William Rumpf, Irvine Clinical Research, Lachlan the Maddened Man, and Jason Kelly. Thank you, title sponsors. And because we don't have a race to talk about, for once, we're going to jump right into the news, Rob. This Christian Horner story is not going away.
No, and there's, you know, as always, there's parts of it that are about, you know, Christian Horner, and then there's the weird Helmut Marko aspect of it all. So in terms of, like, what is the latest, BBC has a story indicating that the woman who has accused Christian Horner of misconduct and harassment is mounting an internal appeal to Red Bull. And the gloss on the story is that, like, if this internal appeal does not succeed or she does not feel like she received a fair hearing, that is the point where there are legal options now against Red Bull. And as far as, like, how all this works, I couldn't begin to tell you. Like, is this a process that she is obliged to follow as part of her own terms of employment with Red Bull? I have no idea. I'm sort of like, you know, I think you'd also read it as this is somebody who has maybe bent over backwards to not end up in a lawsuit with her employer, and is trying to handle it in channels. We just don't know. But either way, like, her, the next step she is taking is, she and her legal team are taking, is an internal appeal to have the decision to clear Horner reviewed and possibly overturned. If that doesn't succeed, the implication is this is probably moving to the court system. And maybe this is, like, the reason I offer, like, why maybe she has to do this to sort of honor obligations to Red Bull is it sounds like the court action from here would probably name Red Bull as someone she's suing in addition to Christian Horner. So, you know, it becomes a thing where if Red Bull is not going to make this right or respond appropriately as far as the alleged victim is concerned, Red Bull becomes sort of a hostile party in the action. So that is where things stand on the legal front. You know, as we noted the other week, you know, there was, you know, the complainant changed legal team. So there are a lot of indications that suggest this is, you know, as we might have all suspected, this is going to head for court. This is not going to end with an internal/ third party subcontractor to Red Bull clearing the matter. This also leaves it leaves a lot of people in an awkward position with regard to this. In particular, it leaves the FIA with a bit of a dilemma as well as to how to handle this, because, and Autosport has the story, the FIA has an anti-harassment and non-discrimination policy. And so the question is whether or not, independent of what Red Bull decides, does the FIA also need to review what has happened here to make sure that Red Bull, and again, Christian Horner, have remained in compliance with the standards that the FIA has set down before, before stakeholders in the sport. This touches on, I can understand why in particular this allegation would be something the FIA would be really hesitant to engage in, because when you're at this level, the difference between, again, like, politics and a standard, you know, personal and professional conduct review are kind of inseparable. There is no way for the FIA to do anything about Christian Horner without also it being the FIA as an organization is taking on Red Bull as an organization and making them subject to, the FIA's policies, the FIA's, processes. But the policy exists, you know, just because it is awkward, the FIA is going to be obliged to look into this. Now, whether the FIA has, you know, especially given various slips with its current leadership, who knows, as far as, like, the standing or credibility an FIA probe would have. But either way, it seems like there is going to be some fallout with the FIA.
Yeah, it'd be hard for them, the FIA, to not do anything, given these, you know, existing standing regulations for the people that are, you know, composing the F1.
And again, this is sort of the complainant. It seems like sort of forcing the hand of the FIA as well. So again, it is a, you know, there's the inquiry going on at Red Bull. Machiner team are having, are appealing. And then there's also now a process started with the FIA, sort of forcing their hand with regard to their own harassment and discrimination policy. Now, this has always been tied to bizarre internal politics at Red Bull.
Do we really know what the connection is besides just people not
that
liking
they're
Christian Horner
concurrently?
Yeah.
I don't know that we do. So it's tough because do you ever get the feeling reading Formula One media that everyone knows more than they're saying?
Yes.
That like the there are sort of strategic leaks that reporters know they're a part of and are writing up stories. People noted very early on with this that there were political overtones to the discussion. I'm kind of with you. Like, it kind of seems like there's been high drama within Red Bull politics maybe for a couple of years, but that may have nothing to do at all with this issue, except insofar as people noted that there seemed to be leaks coming from the Red Bull side of things.
Yeah, and I don't want to insinuate that this harassment claim is happening because someone wants Christian Horner out, that or to suggest that it is fabricated in any way. That is not what I'm saying. I'm saying that perhaps this is someone has seen this as a time to strike.
Yeah, that some of the leaks coming from the Red Bull side indicated like a degree of opportunism.
Yeah.
About like that there were people, and this is not surprising, right? If you take any organization, even a really successful one, if you were to have a powerful leading figure suddenly look like they might have done something wrong that could potentially be fireable, there will be people who would be thinking, well, one, they should be fired, and two, could be good for us as a company, as a team, for them just to be gone. So you have the twofold, like that's sort of where the opportunism comes in. And maybe that's all that's happening here. But to that point about like sort of odd things popping in the F1 press, Autosport had this article that like, I'm kind of curious where it comes from. If I had to guess, it feels like it's coming from the Horner camp almost. But it is about, So the article is, did secret contract move open door for potential Verstappen Red Bull F1 exit? And this is, if this story is true, it kind of feels to me like Red Bull needs to fire everybody at the top of the program, because this seems like malfeasance. If this story is true, but it's so damning, you almost think it's coming from like the Horner side of things to, you know, go after the Mateschitz, not the Mateschitz, the you know, the Helmut Marko camp, and also again maybe make the story not about Christian Horner and harassment allegations. But either way, so we talked before about like there being weird clauses in certain Red Bull contracts about like a Horner clause that if he goes, Adrian Newey goes, etc., things like that.
Or if Marko goes, then Verstappen goes.
Well, that's the interesting one. Because specifically, yes, Max had given really strong votes of confidence for Helmut Marko. And obviously you had Jost talking about, or Jost or Jost Verstappen talking about, you know, Horner's the one tearing the team apart. Things will be bad if he stays. And, you know, crucially, Max has been a bit more tepid in his support for Horner since all this started, which, given what we know, I don't know how you'd be anything but tepid. You know, we just don't know anything about the allegations. But so Verstappen has said that, like, Helmut Marko has to stay. And that's sort of a major, that's sort of a key thing for him. But it would be odd that he would be able to mandate that, unless there were like a contract break clause.
And yeah, when I heard that quote from Verstappen, I kind of just assumed that, like, he was saying that as the one who holds all the cards because he's the hottest commodity in F1 and he's won a bunch of championships and is on top of the world. But you're saying perhaps there's something more legal.
Yeah. Well, remember, Dr. Helmut Marko, it's a doctorate of law. But, okay, so quoting from the article now. In Verstappen's case, it has emerged in recent weeks that the Dutchman does indeed have a break clause if there's a change of senior personnel in his deal that would allow him to walk if Marko is dropped. That would explain why he's been so clear in his comments that if the Austrian veteran is no longer in the picture at Red Bull, then his own future would likely be elsewhere. But what is most intriguing about this Marko exit clause is that, according to sources, and I think sources is doing a lot of work there, it was not part of the original contract that Verstappen and Red Bull signed back in 2022, i.e. a very recent, very lucrative new contract that was signed after his championship. Instead, it is understood that the clause forms part of an addendum to the contract that was added more recently. And even more intriguingly, it has been revealed by insiders that this addition to the original contract was put in place unilaterally by the Verstappens and Marko without Red Bull's F1 team nor Horner knowing anything about it at the time. Marko was able to do this because he is one of the two directors of Red Bull Racing, so was able to act on the team's behalf.
Whoa.
If this is true, this is one of the most holy shit things I've heard in all of in this whole story.
That is, first of all, the separation of church and state here has gotten them into trouble, if this is true. Like, you can't just, unless it's a case where, like, I don't know enough about the inner workings of this stuff to know where the motivation comes from. Because, like, if Marco's, like, employed by Red Bull as their, you know, talent agent, effectively, how does he get swayed into, I am all in on Max Verstappen?
Well, I think, so for me, I, like, when I read this story, there's a part of me that I was like, there are times, this is a story that also makes me feel bad for Max, because I don't think there's any way that a deal like this serves anyone, but, like, it doesn't serve Max, right? These deals do not serve, like, I don't see what Max Verstappen gets out of these deals unless he values stability around him and having the same cast of, like, characters around him so highly, because I understand why Marko would want this deal. You know, you can't get rid of me without losing your championship winning star driver. I understand completely how that serves Marko. I don't understand how it serves Max. I don't understand why you would tie your fate, your future to this guy. Like, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me, unless, you know, you're playing really, like, fourth dimensional chess and you're like, well, they're going to fire Dietrich is dead, they're going to fire Helmut, and this is how I get out of this contract if I want to. But why would he even think about getting out of the contract given how strong the car was? To me, the thing that I find really shocking about it is, like, so if this, I don't know when this came to light, if it was added secretly, I know we talked about it, I do think this is the sort of thing that if you find out, like, a person with signatory capacity at your company did without telling anyone, and they are specifically involved in the addendum, and they have a clear conflict of interest in this particular matter, that to me is, like, that's probably it. right? Like, this is like, I just went through a bunch of like starting a company and figuring out like all the legalese and shit. And the part that like involves a lot of trust is somebody does have to have signatory capacity. You know, I like there's you can't go around to every stakeholder to have them sign every single piece of paper. Somebody needs to have the ability to be like, hey, I filled out these forms. I took care of this thing. I committed us to this. I signed us a contract. Somebody needs to have the power to do that. Even a small company is useful. In a larger one, it's mandatory. The responsibility there is like, the other part of that agreement is that you're just not going to go rogue and start doing shit that like other stakeholders would say, like, hold up there, pump the brakes. That comes with the deal. If you find out that Helmut Marko has obligated the entire Red Bull organization and F1 team to tying their ability to retain their star driver to them keeping this 80-year-old's like Austrian lawyer as a part of their F1 program, and he did it on the sly without letting anyone know, probably because people would have questions and would say, like, absolutely not. That to me is like, your affiliation with the team is at an end. Like, you're done. Like, you're done. This is that. That is a thing that doesn't get walked back. And so when I see a story like this, if this is all real, I totally understand why suddenly Christian Horner would be trying to get Helmut Marko out of the company. I think anyone would. If you discovered that somebody you delegated like executive capacity to was just like, yeah, I made myself unfireable using this kid I've known for ages as part of our F1 like training program. Like, I completely understand now why like there's a battle for control at the top. Somebody misused control and probably needs to go. And I think concurrently with this, probably like, something has happened between Horner and employee that might also render him unfit to remain in his post. And if you're Red Bull at this point, like, both these leadership figures might be so badly compromised, you need to like figure out who's going to be taking this on and batting cleanup. But it's already too late, because if this clause exists, like, Marko has destroyed your relationship with Max.
Yeah, you and know? Himself. I mean, he has burned the ships.
Yep. It's wild to me. I just don't. The other thing is, and again, this is where the reason I think this is really bad for Max. Can you imagine being a team principal at any team that Max Verstappen would want to go to? And learning about like business being conducted in this fashion and being like, I want to bring that. Yeah. Bring the Verstappens into the tent.
Toto sounds like he's game.
If I were Toto, I would sound like I'm game right up until the divorce is finalized. And then I would like extend Russell and bring in somebody else. Like, I would absolutely be like, yeah, we'd love to have Max as a driver. Right up until that team is cratered. And then I'd be like, but you know, there's some other good drivers out there too.
Well, if Horner does go somehow, I know a certain team principal who was just laid off looking for a job.
That is very true.
Get Gunther Steiner in there.
I don't think he has the most Red Bull energy, or leading that team energy, though. I think he does love the spotlight in a fashion that's similar to Horner. But yeah, I don't know. My overall, I think you pointed out something really key there, though, earlier, which is just that I have yet to see a compelling case to be made that any of the allegations about Horner are inherently political or are tied to the struggle for control at Red Bull, except insofar as some other people at Red Bull may have tried to exploit the situation to sort of shortcut around you know, having out who's going to run this team. Mm-hmm. But I think it probably does some injustice to the accusations to say, like, well, they're part of this political right. battle. They're part of this political battle probably because opportunistic people who've been misbehaving on a lot of axes grabbed for them as a cudgel. But I don't think we can evaluate the claims. I don't think, like, all this other stuff really bears on how we can evaluate the claims, which we fundamentally don't know yet.
Yeah.
Again, we'll know a lot when things go to court. But, yeah, like, if this story is true, to me it increasingly sounds like it was a really successful program. These are enormously powerful and arrogant people been running the program for a long time. And sometimes these things cause people to rot. And
as you mentioned, the king has died. You know, Robert Baratheon has been gored by the bull.
He died in 2022, right?
Yeah.
It was around that time. It's like, I wonder if it was an immediate, like, holy shit, we need to start. Yeah, if this is, like, if this is Renly and Ned Stark basically trying to, like, plot the night before. But yeah, I to me, this completely feels like it is possible that every senior leadership figure at this team started to feel like they were indispensable and way too big for their britches, as it were. And yeah, it seems like a big mess that's got to be cleaned up.
Well, speaking, Rob, of secret documents.
Yeah, I mean, I think this isn't really a news story per se. But I did enjoy it. I guess I'll listen to this podcast. Formula1.com wrote up a interview that James Vowles did on the High Performance podcast, talking about how Mercedes they basically created a set of rules to govern how they would handle Lewis and Nico Rosberg during those seasons that they were battling for the championship, you know, culminating with Nico winning the championship and then promptly retiring. And so where this comes is, like, James Vowles was asked about his methodology, the approach he takes with managing drivers, and sort of to illustrate how he approaches sort of open and honest and fair leadership. He starts telling the story. The biggest thing we got into with the drivers in 2014 was that both of them knew, both Nico and Lewis knew, that it was one of those two winning the year. They knew, by the way, before we turned the first wheel in the first race. It took quite a while, but my role in this was I constructed a document that created some very clear guidelines on how are we going to work with each other, how we're going to fight each other, what at the time was called rules of engagement, changed later to another term that was less military, but racing intent. But irrespective, it was some really clear boundaries on this is how we're going to behave, and this is how we're going to perform, and there was a lot to do. And he goes on to sort of describe, like, how the most important thing was, like, making sure the entire thing felt squeaky clean in terms of just how the drivers comported themselves, in terms of, like, the quality of championship that they would win, whoever won it, how would it be regarded as a part of their legacy. He sort of talks about, you know, Schumacher having that year where he's disqualified from the championship for, you know, complete unsportsmanlike behavior on the racetrack. But I more think, like, I do feel like this is the thing that I have seen screwed up more often, and maybe only is workable at a team like Mercedes with characters like Nico and Lewis. I don't know. But doesn't it always feel like you can just detect over team radio that so rarely do the drivers trust that they are being given instructions that are genuinely to the best benefit of the team, and they've taken, you know, it's not slanted toward one driver or another. So often to me, it feels like you can hear the drivers the second they hear an instruction that requires any sort of, like, conceding anything to their teammate. You just detect that they think the fix is in, that they're terrified that this signals that, like, I'm being downgraded to number two and it's never going to stop.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is fascinating, especially because, you know, having gleaned some insight on Val's personality from Drive to Survive, the fact that he made a document just makes so much sense. And it's so, like, I think it sounds pretty effective, frankly. If you can get sign-off on both of your hotshot drivers that, like, here's how we're going to behave, then you can say, like, listen, when things go south, we will have some, at least one person to blame.
And I think you got to, like, I think the other part of this is you have to be able, like, I think the driver would have to have confidence that you will also make sure those rules are adhered to. You know, mm-hmm. that, like, the second it was like, here's a big document with all our rules, but then if the driver sensed that, like, you know, but if Toto feels like the moment has come to strike and go in for the kill or something, it's not going to work. The minute they feel those rules can be thrown out, you know, based on a whim. So there has to be, you know, there has to be that buy-in that, like, the team's commitment to operating this way is ironclad. Yeah, it seems like a good fit for Vols. And it does sort of speak to, we often noted that, like, when difficult things had to be said over the radio at Mercedes, or things had to be tamped down, Lewis, it's James, mm-hmm. was like the end of the discussion.
Yeah.
And I mean, it says a lot about how you conduct yourself if, like, that has the sort of moral authority to, like, no, this guy's saying this is how it is. Everyone's going to get on the same page now. This is just how it has to be. You know, that is a reputation and a level of, like, trust and authority that sort of earned, not granted.
Well, as this, as a Val's stan, I will have to go listen to this podcast. All right. Well, that is it for news. We are going to take a break, and then we'll be back with the track walk. And we're back with the track walk. The Albert Park Circuit, located in Melbourne on the southeastern coast of Australia, is a 3.3 mile or 5.3 kilometer track that uses public roads that run around a lake, Albert Lake. The Australian Grand Prix has been here every year since 1996, bar 2020 and 2021 due to COVID. In fact, the 2020 race was called off at pretty much the last possible minute, just a few hours before free practice one. I don't know if you remember that, Rob, but I remember pretty clearly it being very strange. Track has 14 corners currently and four DRS zones, though only two detection points. It's one of the faster tracks on the calendar. Hamilton's pole lap in 2019 saw an average speed of 146 miles per hour, or 235 kilometers per hour. Normally, the streets have a speed limit of 40 kilometers per hour, which is 25 miles an hour. And because it's a temporary circuit, it can be pretty bumpy, though it was resurfaced in 2022. Along with that came a reprofile of a few turns, most notably smoothing the old turns 9 and 10, which are now the third DRS zone.
Mm-hmm.
To try and improve passing, because what was happening was there were a lot of these kind of tight right-hand corners and not a lot of long zones to speed up into them. So they've created much longer runs with this new layout. The pit lane was also widened during this. That increased the pit speed limit from 60 to 80 kilometers an hour. And it's a track that kind of has everything. So to hear Hamilton say it, quote, "It's fast flowing and you really have to attack it. The car has to be set up in a balanced way. Too much aggression and you'll damage the tires, but too cautious and you won't go fast enough," end quote. So from the first corner, you've got a sharp right-hander followed by a quick back and forth at turns 3 and 4. And then you get into the back half of the track, which has those two back-to-back straights. Last five winners have been Verstappen in 2023, then Leclerc, Bottas, Vettel in 2017. Apparently, I just learned this, Bernie Eccleston wanted to make it a night race in 2007. But the lighting that was that the circuit needed was deemed to be too expensive. That would certainly make the the times a little more watchable. I'll get to that. I also wanted to put together sort of, after the two races, we've kind of had a better look at teams' cars and how they're doing. And they've been, the teams have been a little more forthcoming with maybe some of their things that they're trying to improve. So I'll start with Aston Martin here. Autosport has a quote from performance director Tom McCullough, who he's explaining why they've looked, Aston Martin has looked better in qualifying than the race, which is kind of the inverse of how they did last year. And it's, I just thought this was a little counterintuitive. So he says the efficiency of the car, the DRS switch is something we really worked hard on last year as we saw how strong the Red Bull was. That's part of the reason we've qualified well. I was looking at the difference between qualifying last year and this year with nearly identical wind direction and wind speed. The difference was quite big. We gained a lot of lap time from that. So because the cars, the drivers can open DRS at any time in a DRS zone, regardless of whether they are within 1 second of the car in front during qualifying, thus the DRS wing opening can have a outsized effect on qualifying. I just thought that was interesting. So it's not that they've gotten better necessarily in qualifying. It's that they, like he's chalking it up mostly to the DRS. Or rather, they haven't gotten worse in the race. They've gotten better in qualifying. Mm-hmm. Just an interesting way to look at it. Alpine, we've talked a little bit about why they have really plummeted so far. We've got some, it's another Autosport article. They note that the power unit is one area. It's down between 15 and 30 horsepower, which in the very tight midfield makes a lot of difference. Yes, Rob?
Well, I'm just like, 15, 20, like, I feel like last year they were conceding that they were maybe down 7 or 8. Mm. Well, maybe there's a bit of working the refs here. Maybe they're going to try to renew that, like, we're just so low on power, you've got to slow the other teams down so that we can be competitive. But, like, man, that's debilitating.
Yeah. We also, I believe, had talked previously that they had to pass a specific crash test over the winter, and that meant adding an extra 15 kilograms over what was originally intended, which pushed it quite up above the minimum weight limit. They say that it might not, that figure might not be accurate, as it seems quite excessive. But it's from the article, asked if some crash test failures had played a part in the extra weight, the team's former technical director Matt Harmon said before he was let go just after Bahrain, if it played some part, or if some crash test failures had played a part. He says not some, it was one in particular. It has played a bit of a part in some of that. We know exactly where the weight is and we know how to take it out. So look forward to that, I guess. Also, this article points out that and this is more recently that we've that the team has talked about this. Harmon is talking about last year's car, saying that midway through, we started to find it more and more difficult to find performance. So we thought, let's try and unlock that potential and try to get ourselves back to where we were in 2022. It was a courageous decision to take because fundamentally we need potential for 2 years with this car. And if we don't do that, then we may be struggling later on. That was the whole point of this. And this, he means they, or at least what I'm taking from this, is that they drastically redesigned the car from 2023, since they had hit a ceiling for this 2024 car, and it really has not paid off. Last one here is Mercedes. So they noted, this is trackside engineering director Andrew Shovlin in an article from Racer magazine. They apparently did different setups for the driver in Jeddah, but they showed the same thing. So he's saying that tells you it's not a small difference. It's not a tiny bit of camber or a spring bar here and there. It's something more fundamental that we need to dig into and understand. Otherwise, they would see a difference, right? Because they set the cars up differently. Balance is one big thing. He says in regards to Jeddah, those are very fast corners. The walls aren't particularly far away, so there are ones where the driver wants a lot of confidence, and quite often we were snapping to oversteer if they really leaned on the tires. You can easily imagine how unsettling that is for the drivers. So it's not just about overall speed. It's about, you know, can the driver feel confident to put the speed into the car without crashing? He goes on to talk about porpoising and grip. In qualifying, we're also suffering a bit with the bouncing. That was less of a problem in the race. There's more fuel in the car, so you're going a bit slower. And that seemed to calm down and wasn't such an issue. The big one is we don't really have enough grip in high-speed corners. So that's one of the things that we were working hard on this week, because Melbourne has similar nature of corners. We're doing a lot of work to try and understand why we did not seem to have the grip of some of our close competitors. So, that is what people are working on. And perhaps we will see the fruits of all that labor soon.
Just the stuff about porpoising reminded me. Just as a news story, we don't need to get into too much. But Lando Norris was talking to media this week about, like, the next redesign of the F1 cars needs to take driver comfort into account more. Mm-hmm. And what he was specifically talking about was, like, these things are grueling to drive because of, you know, porpoising stopped being a story that we talk about week after week. But, like, they are still really physically punishing cars to drive, and like Lando's talking about, like, just a growing number of, you know, back problems, you know, need to do more therapeutic type exercises.
He's
to
24.
Maintain. That's the thing. It seems real. Like, it was concerning when, like, you know, back in like 2019, 2020 or something, like, you'd see Lewis, there seemed to be evidence that there was a growing stiffness in his back when he was getting out of the car. But you sort of expect that for a dude racing cars through his 30s. Lando's really young, and to be like, kind of sounds like he's talking around having a bad back, which, you know, sometimes you just get unlucky with that. But it sort of seems like these cars, you no longer have the dramatic, like, porpoising that nobody could tolerate happening as much anymore. But it still sounds like it's not a great spec car for drivers physically. The other thing, just the stuff about Alpine and that crash test, man. Like, when's the last time you heard about a crash test, like a car design being completely compromised because of a failed crash test and having to add a bunch of weight? I feel like I've never heard that in modern F1.
No, me neither.
Like, the I don't think crash standards, like, have shifted that much since the introduction of the Halo. Maybe there's little, like, things that we just don't hear about that are in the rules that change year to year. But, like, man, if you're telling me, like, our car's messed up because we failed a crash test, it's good. You know, obviously, it's good that we have standards to make sure everyone can race safely. But I don't know. It seems like maybe you're not doing a great job designing the car to these really, like, known basic specs.
Yeah, I equate it a little bit to, it makes me think of, game design. Like, you can't ship a game without, like, you know, controller support for the Xbox version. You know, there are certain things that just have to be in there.
Yeah, it's an alarming place. A lot of teams feel like they're in a bit of an alarming place right now. Some maybe only relatively, based on just how badly Red Bull's kicking their butts. But some of these teams just don't sound like they're in an amazing spot with regard to their car.
Yeah. Maybe an amazing spot, the Albert Park circuit this weekend. We're looking at 68 degrees Fahrenheit or 20 Celsius on qualifying day, just a few degrees higher on race day at 70 or 21. Precipitation looks to be about 0 to 5% across the weekend, although looks to be maybe some significant wind, 14 miles an hour out of the south on qualifying day. And then same speed out of the southwest, that is 23 kilometers an hour on race day. They are right on, it's a bay. So the wind could be whipping across the water there. So look out for that, I guess, if you're a Formula One car. 2024 driver standings. Here we go. Heading into Australia, Max Verstappen is on top with 51 points. Sergio Perez, his teammate with 36, is in second. Then we've got Charles Leclerc with 28, George Russell with 18, Oscar Piastri with 16 in fifth. Then we've got Carlos Sainz in sixth with 15, Fernando Alonso and Lando Norris with 12 each, Lewis Hamilton with 8, and Oliver Bearman in 10th with 6 points. Then Nico Hülkenberg and Lance Stroll all have 1, and the rest, Alex Albon, Zhou Guanyu, Kevin Magnussen, Daniel Ricciardo, Esteban Ocon, Yuki Tsunoda, Logan Sargeant, Valtteri Bottas, and Pierre Gasly all have 0. In the constructor standings, Red Bull Racing is on top with 87. Ferrari is in second with 49. McLaren's in third with 28. Mercedes close behind in fourth with 26. Aston Martin's in fifth with 13. Gene Haas and team have 1 point. And then Williams, Sauber, RB, and Alpine all have 0. If you'd like to join the standings yourself, you can do so with the official Shift F1 Fantasy League. You can join it using the link in the show notes. Don't have to start from the beginning. You can win individual races and have your preferably punny team name read out on the show. You can also send us an email at shiftf1podcast@gmail.com or through the web interface at f1.cool/emails. Rob, you've selected some emails here. You want to kick it off?
Yeah. Aaron writes, a recent episode of the Escape Collectives, a relatively new entrant in bike racing media, performance process podcast, featured an interview with Jack Aitken, former Williams Reserve driver and current IMSA driver of Cadillac. The many similarities that and transferable skills between bike racing and F1. It's an illuminating discussion, not only on the affinities between the sports in terms of aerodynamics, racecraft, cornering, greenwashing, etc., but also on many aspects of the physical and mental endurance required to race cars door-to-door for hours on end. It seems that, with the notable exception of Lance Stroll and his broken wrists, riding and racing bikes has substantial benefits for driving and racing cars. The benefits probably carry over to fans as well. If this year ends up being another Max Verstappen show with most races decided within the first 3 laps, I'd recommend F1 fans supplement their sports diet with some pro cycling. It's got all the strategy, high-speed corners, dubious sports-washing sponsors, fragile machines, and equally fragile egos that an F1 fan craves, plus races with countless plot twists that often come down to a photo finish. I started getting into cycling last year. And one, do you love beautiful aerial photography of parts of Europe you could never afford to live in?
I sure do.
But also, the more I started to watch it, the more I started dialing into the strategy, and I was like, holy shit, this is a fascinating sport.
How does one get into this, Rob? Is there a Shift F1 equivalent?
Not that I found. I mean, I mostly watched, it sounds like this might be, the, you know, Escape Collective, you know, maybe that's it, but I didn't find anything. I just sort of, the nice thing is you watch the Tour de France, you'll pick up a lot because they explain it as if you've never seen it before. Cause that's a good assumption. Yeah. So many people tune into that one and they don't tune into anything else.
Yeah. There's that Netflix show though, right?
Oh, yes. I've lost track of all of them. Like Full Swing is their golf one. Uh-huh. Quarterback, I think, is their. What is Netflix cycling show? Are you into pro cycling? I feel like I asked this last year.
Only on a very high level. Tour de France, Unchained.
Yeah. Unchained. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've watched, you know, a few hours here and there of the Tour de France. I agree that it's the right mix of depth and esoteric sport that really captures my attention.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. I think the other thing that I used to, like, I knew enough to know that, like, there's your guy who's riding for the overall win. Then there's guys who are, like, really good at climbing the hills. Mm-hmm. And there's dudes who are really, really fast. I think I hadn't fully realized that setting those guys up to succeed, though, if it's a mountain stage or you're trying to get your general, your overall winner rider in a position to win, still requires all those other dudes to, like, mm-hmm. in some ways, like a cycling team is like the machine you are building is made of people, right? Like the car you are sending out there is a platoon of riders that on the given day are going to set things up to let one driver strike at the right moment and have a shot of winning. And everything has to be choreographed around that. And it's just a wild amount of strategy. Because you think, you know, it's an athletic sport. Like, the guy who's going to be fat, like the guy who's strongest and most durable, you know, can handle the mountain the best, he's going to win the mountain stage. No, he isn't. Not unless, like, a bunch of people set it up for him to do that, because otherwise all those advantages will be mooted. It's a really fascinating sport. I started getting into it last year. I'm on the verge of sicko territory with it.
Nice.
You want to read this next one?
Sure. Yeah, I thought initially we were talking about motorbike racing, but we are bicycle racing.
I didn't know Jack Aitken was a cyclist. Yeah,
I didn't know either. I was all about ready to go, like, well, there were always rumors that Valentino Rossi was going to come over to F1.
Yeah.
I think he and Lewis actually did, like, a media day where they swapped cars and bikes, but... Yeah, this next one, Elizabeth writes, "Hi, Shifters. Do you find it surprising that Lewis Hamilton didn't wait until seeing the on-track performance of the 2024 Ferrari to sign over to them? Writing this just after testing, the SF24 does seem to solidly be the second-best car, but was it that clear to him just from the sim data the team gave him, or was it more to do with what they've got cooking for the 2026 car?" I wonder how much information they are allowed to give or
want.
That
was my thought, too. I'm not sure they can.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, like, F1 is so paranoid about controlling this material.
Mm-hmm. And, God, Ferrari especially.
Yeah. Like, I don't know that they can. For me, this came up a little bit. People hear a conversation about the second half of the Drive to Survive season. But we came away from an episode that sort of centers on Lewis and Mercedes and all that, feeling like it does. Obviously, there's 20/20 hindsight. You know, we know that Lewis is going to leave for Ferrari. But at the end of the episode, you feel like that relationship is still not on healthy footing. And it feels like a lot of it stems from the fact that they built Lewis a bad car in 2022, and then they doubled down on it against his will in 2023. None of that worked out. I kind of wonder if he just wanted out, you know, that, like, he didn't have faith that Mercedes were going to pull it together on a timeline that worked for him.
Yeah, and interestingly, in this article from Formula1.com, so asterisk state-run media, he was asked kind of about this. Like, did you leave Mercedes because you don't believe in it? And he said, basically, no. He says that, "I'm excited about this year, and I know this team is going to win another championship, and I will be proud to know that I've been a part of it. As I said, it's all about a new chapter in my life, and I really feel like I've done everything I could possibly do with this team. Mercedes has such an incredible history, and from the board down, they are really ultimately heavily invested in racing in so many areas, regardless of whether or not this is a championship-winning car. That won't have any bearing on how I feel about the next stage of my career. It's an incredible group of people, and it's really well-run. I'm on the back end of my career. I love a challenge, and this is the ultimate challenge, really. And this is maybe the opposite of what Elizabeth was saying. This is the ultimate challenge, really, to go to a team that is incredibly iconic, has also amazing history, but also has not had as much success, I guess, as they would have hoped in the past decade or so. My goal is to beat them this year, and obviously that switches next year on.
Well, one, I feel like some of what he's saying there is a bit like, it's very call your girlfriend. In so far as like, and then you tell Mercedes that you know they're going to win a championship again, but just not with you, and you're going to be somewhere else. And two, like, it would be the most Lewis Hamilton thing in the world. Like, if the blessed career continues with, he's like, man, I just hope I can help Ferrari get back to where that iconic team belongs. As they are on the upswing and like surpassing Mercedes, and like he steps into a car that's like ready to rock for a championship.
Yeah. I believe him though.
Yeah. I mean, I still fundamentally think it's like your bucket list item is it's Ferrari.
Yeah. Like, and like you said, I'm on the backstage of my career.
Yeah. Like, this is your one chance to answer that question. Like, what would it be like to Ferrari driver? And I think like that is a priceless question. It is a different, like, it is a, you know what winning a championship's like. You can win more races, but like driving Ferrari is going to be special. I think fundamentally that's the reason. But I do think like just the way that they miss that Mercedes fumbled the development of the car since, you know, 2021 basically, probably burned through some of that patience. Scott writes, this weekend, we got a few emails along these lines, but Scott writes, this weekend, Ollie Bearman filled in for Carlos Sainz, who had appendicitis and finished the race in seventh. This led many to exclaim, what an amazing drive it was, earned him driver of the day, and opened the discussion of how he deserves an F1 seat as soon as possible. Time travel back to 2022 at Monza, where Nick DeVries filled in for Alex Albon, who also suffered from appendicitis. Nick finished in the points, ninth, and also won driver of the day. Nick's performance at Monza led him to getting an F1 seat in 2023, which ended up lasting less than half a season before he was replaced due to poor performance. So while Ollie's performance was pretty astounding to watch, why should we believe this isn't going to be another DeVries situation?
That is a great question.
So I'll say this. Jeddah has a reputation for being a bastard of a track. And Monza is nuanced. You know what I mean? Like, it takes a lot to get like a perfect lap at Monza. You really gotta, there's a lot of nuance to what is otherwise a pretty simple track layout. It is a pretty simple track layout. Like, come on, when it comes up in the racing game, like how many breakpoints do you really need to nail? You know, how many ones do you need to remember? Not that many. You know them really, really well, and you know if the car is doing well, you can succeed. Jeddah apparently is kind of a really tricky track. Little margin for error, endless lap, lots of visually indistinct corners. So like turning in a good performance there, I think does go a little bit further, but. I did know, yes, people are very kind on the air. People love a good heartwarming story. But it did sort of seem like people were like, yeah, he deserves an F1 seat. Man, we'll see him in F1 seat soon. But I also noted that people weren't like saying immediately this is going to change our plans for how we're going to distribute F1 seats. Like everyone was like, that was great. But I didn't see a lot of like movement to rush him forward. Beyond kind words, I'm not sure he materially moved up in the pipeline.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, I'm not making these calls for the teams, but I think what stood out to me was the fact that immediately he was making moves. He was making, you know, challenges to overtake. Instead of just like trying to hang on to the end of the race. I honestly don't remember much about Nick DeVries's race. I do remember that happening. I don't remember, his actual, performance in that race. I think you're right about the track. I think with, such little time also.
Yeah.
Just the fact that he just exuded a stability that I think was surprising, given his young age. But yeah, I wonder if it's less about like who are we gonna fire, and more of a perspective setting for like, okay, do we really need to hang on to these guys that we've hung on to for so long? Or is there a possibility that these up and comers would actually be as good or better than them from the get-go? Because we've also seen the opposite, right? We've seen, rookies come in and be not great. I don't know. I just thought it was fun.
Yeah, these are heartwarming stories. Somebody else wrote in, the other point they made was like, are we sure it isn't a testament to how good that Ferrari is? That setting a decent pace in it means you sort of move well up the table into the points. I think that's probably a fair read. But we have seen ample evidence that like just being able to extract like the par performance from an F1 car requires some real craft. Like, yeah. We see a lot of guys who weren't able to do it in their time in the sport. So, who knows? Drew, you want to read this last one?
Yes. Zach writes, I hear a lot of talk about getting rid of practice or it not being essential watching, but let me take you back to Monaco 2023. Fernando Alonso takes provisional pole with a stellar lap. Max is the only one who could beat him, but he goes yellow in sector 2. Alonso seems a lock, but at my F1 viewing party with my friends around, I say Max has got this by a tenth. Seconds later, Max is on pole. Flashback to FP2 and FP3. Max improves on his time by consistently sacrificing Sector 2 to go all out in 3. The commentators don't mention it, and it's not on the practice highlights video, but it's consistently purple, yellow, purple. You'll note in Q2 and Q1, Max doesn't do this. He saves it for when it matters most. You only know this by watching all FP sessions like a hawk and taking notes so that you can be the most annoying person ever at your F1 watch party. And isn't that the goal we are all striving for? It absolutely is, Zach.
Look, is Zach basically telling us a story about how they were once the smartest person in the room about like what was happening in an F1 weekend?
Yes.
Yeah. But this is a pretty cool insight to pull off that like, sort of clocking the fact that Max was basically dumping performance in one sector to gain more and more performance in the last one, and that all pays off in the qualifying. I think for me, that is less an argument for like you should watch practice than maybe we should expect more of our F1 commentary teams. Mm. Like, I'm not paid to notice this shit, and I'm certainly not paid to watch practice. But like, that is the sort of thing I would sort of expect somebody in the constellation of analysts they bring with them, who admittedly have a whole lot of stuff to analyze, but like that's the sort of thing that you might like see drawn out as a talking point a bit more often. But
it does sound like
covering 20 cars.
Yeah, and it sounds like something that you would see Julian Palmer talking about after the fact, right?
Yeah.
Or Sam Collins pointing out something on a screen. And for that, I suggest if people are really interested to look at the F1 TV stuff that those guys post.
Highly recommended. The Julian Palmer show is great. Drew, I hate their new set. I hate the set they've got Julian Palmer
on. Oh, I don't know that I've seen it.
It's a huge... It was like, it's a bigger set. And he was like, it's a bigger and better set. It looks like... It's got it's all their neon color scheme, and so it's just kind of like hard to look at, and it's going for that like illusion of depth that the like inside the NBA set goes for, but it's just like, man, it is hard to watch. It's like staring at a migraine.
Oh man. Oh yeah. Okay.
And also, is there any complexion and any wardrobe you think will look good against that backdrop?
I mean, it's gamer purple. Yeah. What I'm seeing.
Right.
And he is very tiny. It's all a virtual set.
Yeah.
Okay, I could see why on paper this would look interesting, but yeah. All right. Some of it, so I'm looking at Formula One's YouTube channel. Some of that stuff goes to YouTube, in case you don't have a subscription to F1 TV. So check out Julian Palmer's analysis.
And we can't easily get an F1 TV because we never accept the cookies, but then we never accept the cookie that allows our credentials to be saved between sessions.
It's true. It's true. All right, that's it for emails. You could, again, email us at shiftf1podcast@gmail.com or go to f1.cool/emails. You could also hit us up on the socials using the links in the show notes. That's us around the internet. It's time now to take it around the world of racing. The Repco Supercars will be supporting Formula One at the Albert Park Grand Prix circuit this weekend. Thursday through Sunday, there are four races. That's a lot of supercars. I like supercars. We've also got MotoGP. They are back at the Autodromo Internacional do Algarve in Portimão, Portugal. The World Superbike Championship is at the Barcelona Catalunya circuit. F2 and F3 are also supporting F1 in Albert Park this weekend. We got those Craftsman trucks at the Circuit of the Americas for the XPEL 225. The NASCAR Xfinity Series is also at COTA for the Focused Health 200. What else we got? IndyCar is at, what is this, the Thermal Club? Rob, do you know what the Thermal Club is?
Well, Thermal is a famous raceway.
Oh. I didn't know that. Where is it?
Is it in California, maybe? Or
is it is in Thermal, Florida? California. Yeah. I've never heard of Thermal. Anyway, the race is called the $1 Million Challenge. Is this a reality show?
$1 Million. This is the sort of topical references you get on Shift F1.
It really is. The NHRA Lucas Oil Winternationals, parentheses Pomona, is at the Auto Club Raceway in Pomona, California. That one I have heard of. And we got NASCAR also at Circuit of the United States of Americas for the Echo Park Automotive Grand Prix.
I'm always here to watch stuff. It's at COTA. Last year that race was unwatchable with the number of yellows. Like, I was like, I cannot.
Yeah, I mean,
these dudes could not get the race restarted without somebody going off and causing another like 20-minute delay.
Well, Rob, there's so many right turns.
Yep. You
know? Formula One also this weekend, maybe you've heard of it. It's a normal weekend, not a sprint, although it's in Australian time, so watch out. These are Eastern times. Free Practice 1 kicks off Thursday, March 21st. It's late here. It's GDC week. I'm tired. March 21st at 9:30 p.m. on ESPN News. a few hours later, at 1 a.m. on Friday, March 22nd, on ESPN2 is Free Practice 2. Followed by, I guess, at 9:30 p.m., Free Practice 3 on ESPN News. Then Saturday, March 23rd, qualifying is at 1 a.m. Eastern Time on ESPN2. And the race, everyone, Sunday, March 24th at 12 midnight Eastern Time on ESPN2. The deuce. We will post, as usual, the schedule for this weekend. In case you can't parse all of that, I'm having trouble parsing it, and I'm looking at it right now. So stay tuned to the socials for that. Final thoughts, Rob, ahead of Australia.
It's a great track. Always looking forward to it. Hopefully, I'm still hoping somebody's going to be able to bring a package that's competitive for a win, but yeah, it does seem like that's not in the cards this year. But hopefully we at least see an abatement of some of the things that Danny noticed early on, which was just that some of the mid-pack action is dying off and it's becoming a bit more processional. The DRS trains are harder to break. You know, last year there was a lot of good action in the mid-pack. If it starts turning into a bit more deterministic in terms of how they run, gonna be a rough season. Because, you know, Max can run away with the lead, but last year we had a lot to talk about because there was always so much happening behind. Mm-hmm. Last couple races have definitely felt like, well, and then the running order kind of gets sorted out, and you just kind of hang. And I hope we don't have another race like that.
Yeah. I don't know if Australia is going to be it, but, you know, because, I don't know. Maybe those changes that they made to it will increase passing. And we'll see. We'll see, we'll see, we'll see. If you'd like to support the show and get access to all of our bonus episodes, the ad-free version of the podcast, and the official Shift F1 Discord, you can do so over at patreon.com/ShiftF1. Have a good race weekend, everyone. We will see you all next week.
Meow.